Hello and welcome to the Church History Podcast with Susan Easton Black and myself, Clayton Pixton. We're going to open this one up with a little song. This is How Firm a Foundation. How firm a foundation, ye saints of the Lord, is laid for your faith in his excellent word. What more can he say than to you he hath said, who unto the Savior, who unto the Savior, who unto the Savior for refuge have fled. All right. Susan, how are you today?
I'm doing great. I loved that hymn. It was a favorite back in the old Nauvoo days.
Yeah, it was included in the first hymn book, right?
Uh-huh, yep.
By Emma Smith. I'm trying to do some of those to start out with. Well, again, Susan Easton Black and I are here to discuss church history, and we're on our fourth episode. We talked about the ancestry of Joseph Smith in the first one, and then the first vision.
That's right.
And then kind of the angel Moroni.
Right, and today we're going to talk about Martin Harris. He's the first man that we know of that becomes a confidant to the Smiths and learns from them about the Book of Mormon. So we're going to talk about Martin Harris, the uncompromising witness of the Book of Mormon. For Martin Harris, he's wearing a chin beard. I don't think that's very popular today. What do you think, Clayton?
It's hard to get used to. I'm not a big chin beard guy today, but...
Okay, I think that too, but unfortunately for us, it's the only photograph taken of Martin Harris. You know, wish we had a younger one, but we're going to learn a little bit about this man, and I think our listening audience would find him pretty interesting. So what we know about him, if we look way back when, is that his family came to America, his ancestors, and you describe them as nonconformists. They were separatists. They were anxious to get out of Great Britain and believed that there was a difference between church and religion. And it's interesting, Martin's first ancestor to leave the British Isles was named Thomas Harris. And what's so interesting about that? So you're going to find that Martin, if we were to look at who's descended from these people, you'd say descended from Thomas Harris aboard that ship is a man named President Dallin H. Oaks, Dallin Harris Oaks. And then the other man you see is Jeff Holland, and Jeffrey R. Holland, he's descended from another man aboard ship, Roger Williams, a great separatist. So I think it's so interesting, two men that both served as president of BYU and then together in the Quorum of the Twelve, and would be descended from people from the same time period, same ship, all of that. Well, the big question is, obviously, they come to America and they land. So we're going to find that where they eventually set up is in Rhode Island. Now, for the Harris family, they didn't make their money on the farm. Where they're going to make their money will be in the Harris quarries. And so what we're going to find is that in these rock quarries there in Rhode Island, literally generations of the Harris family will be able to support themselves pounding on rocks, something I'd not like to do. What about you, Clayton?
That would be a hard on the body.
Really hard.
Jobs that would be hard on the body.
Oh, for sure. And you'd say, what religion then do the Harris family traditionally join? And it's the Quaker religion, where you get the women and the men very quiet until someone feels inspired to say something in their meeting. If you were to say, well, who were the first then of the Harris family to move out of Rhode Island? And it's actually Martin's father, Nathan, and his brother, Rufus. And they moved to the state of New York. Now, it will be in New York that Martin is born. He is born in 1783. in a place called Easton, New York. I like the name of his town. How could I forget that? You know, Susan Easton Black and
what a great
Easton,
name.
New York. Yeah, great name. I think it works. And you'd say, how's his family doing? Well, they're always pushing west. And the next place they push to is a place called Swift's Landing. You may recall from, I think it was the second time we were together, Clayton, we talked about Joseph Smith and his family moving to Swift's Landing, but they changed the name of that to Palmyra, after a Syrian goddess. You'd say, what's the difference between the Smiths and the Harris family as they move into town? Well, the Harris family brought money, and they're able to buy 600 acres at a time when we're saying if you could own 100 acres, then you could support a family, not have to have an extra job. But for the Harris family, they purchased 600 acres. And you'd say for the father of the family, Nathan, well, he became famous in the town of Palmyra, not necessarily for his wealth, but he becomes famous because he's really good with a gun. And it was said that, you know, if there were wild animals to be shot, they'd always want to ask Harris to do it. And eventually he becomes a constable. Can you see why? And yeah. If there was any fish to be caught, he's the man. And they used to nickname him the Nimrod as well as Trout Harris.
So Nimrod is the mighty hunter in the Old Testament, right?
Yep, that's him. And so you'd say, well, Martin, did you get any of those traits? And it doesn't appear to be so. So, you know, father, son, were they alike? Oh, I'm not sure. What Martin seemed to enjoy as a youth growing up, he always liked what were called barn raisings. And it's like the whole town would come together. They'd have a lot of food and they'd help each other and they'd raise these barns on their properties. Well, as a youth, you can imagine then which church Martin will attend. He's always in the Quaker church, but obviously that will change. For Martin, at times they met in the Quaker church, or sometimes they met in private homes, depending on who's telling the story. But you could always pick out Quakers in Palmyra. In fact, there were 45 families in this small little fledgling town of Palmyra who were Quakers, and you could always tell them by their dress as they went up and down Main Street. You can see that the women, they always wore, little white kind of almost doily hats, and the men always wore a broad brim hat. Well, what else was Dad in town? You'd say Dad was what was called a pathmaster, which meant his job was to keep the road free from weeds passable that would lead up to his home. And his 600 acres, he's a constable. Well, of course, you'd make your Nimrod in the town a constable. And horror of horrors, he's the tax collector also. So I guess it would depend on which role he was playing, how much you liked him. Well, what do we know about Martin by the time the dad is all of these things in Palmyra? What we know about Martin is that by the time he's 25, he's still a bachelor. And I'm sure his parents were going, come on, Martin, find somebody, right? But his responsibility, as dad kind of takes a back seat and gets more involved in civic affairs in town, Martin now begins to manage all of his dad's estate. So his farm, his business, and you'd say he's a very eligible bachelor. He's got a really good job, you know, kind of like dad is going, things are much better under your hands. You just do this, son. And so finally, we look and we say, well, Martin, okay, I guess you're going to marry. Who will it be? And the person that Martin marries at 25 is a young woman named Lucy Harris, age 16. And the interesting thing is that Lucy Harris is his first cousin. And that when her father dies, you know, this Rufus that came out with Martin's father to Palmyra, when her father dies, she then grows up in the home of Martin. And so Martin doesn't just know her as a first cousin living down the street, but has known her because she's actually lived in the home. And so 25-year-old Martin will marry his cousin, Lucy, who is 16. It is assumed that it is a Quaker marriage, and Quaker marriages at that time, the young couple would be brought forward, and they'd sit there, they'd wait the wait, and then when Martin would reach out and reach for her hand, if she put her hand in Martin's, they were then pronounced married. A lot different than a temple ceremony. You know, a lot different than, you know, will you and yes, I do take this bride. You'd say for Martin, was it a happy marriage? It appears so at first. They have children in this marriage, four that live to adulthood. And you'd say for Martin, the big question is, does he establish a business on Main Street? And kind of a look at Palmyra's Main Street, you'd say, no, Martin never does. So he doesn't have a shoe shop. He doesn't have a blacksmith. Nothing on Main Street for an extra income, because basically he doesn't need it. And you'd say even for a wedding gift, he is given acreage. Now, those are the good old days. We all missed it, right, Clayton? So that was him. You'd say after he marries, he continues to manage his dad's farm. He also suddenly becomes an important man in the community. He becomes what's called an overseer of highways and fences in Palmyra, which meant his job was to check on all the pathmasters, like his father, make sure they were keeping their fences right, no cows, stray animals were getting through, and the roads were all passable. In addition, Martin was able to piece together a 150-acre farm. And with that, you'd say, wow, he's doing great. And now we come to the War of 1812. In the War of 1812, it was said by this point of Martin Harris that no one in Palmyra was more promising than him. Now, it used to be in the War of 1812, every man between the ages of 18 and 45 that was considered physically able enlisted in a local militia unit, and then off you went to fight in the war. But if you had money, you could pay for a substitute to take your place and get credit for fighting in the war. In the case of Martin, he had so much money that he actually hired a substitute. And so, although years later, his widow will receive a widow's pension for her husband's military service, as far as service in a war that actually goes on for about 3 years, Martin only spent 9 days, and the rest of his service was done by substitutes. You know, how would that be? But advantage of wealth at his time. Martin, by this point, is known as a gentleman farmer. And you'd say people liked him. The year is 1816, and in this same year, we now look at Joseph Smith Sr. 1816 is actually the time that some of you may recall that Joseph Smith Sr. will first come to Palmyra and then eventually joined by his family, and recall that a stranger will pick up and bring young Joseph Smith into town. You may also recall that while Joseph was in town along with Martin, that it was a period of great religious revivals. Now, obviously, the Smiths got a little bit involved in that. As you see, Lucy Mack Smith and Hiram and Sophronia and Samuel becoming part of the Western Presbyterian Church. But we're going to say, for Martin, how is he affected by the religious revivals? Well, Martin joins almost every church that comes through. And you go, at one point, recall he's a Quaker when he's a youth, young man, married man, father. And then as the revivals are going on leading up to 1820, Martin becomes a Universalist. He's a Restorationer. He's a Baptist. He's a Presbyterian. He's a Methodist. He belongs to the Episcopal Church. In other words, you'd say, how are you doing, Martin?
There's a man who's searching.
He is searching. And
not to spoil it, right? But even after, I hope I'm not spoiling it, but after he kind of parted ways with Joseph Smith and the Strangites and the...
Yeah, he does the same thing, right? Searching.
Joined numerous of those.
Yep. So
before coming back.
Right. So that's our man. I mean, you'd say if you're looking for a church of the time period, he's pretty much finding them all and checking them all out. But by the year 1818, Martin is now 35 years old, and his conclusion is, I'm an unchurched Christian. In other words, I believe in Christ, but I'm telling you, I just can't seem to find the right church to really land in that I really want to hold on to. Now, his wife, Lucy, is going to be a Quaker through all this time, so you can imagine this cannot be happy news at home, where Martin's saying, you'll never guess where I'm going tonight. I'm trying the Baptist, the Methodist. Until 1818, as he pronounces he's unchurched, he claims he has a revelation in which he learns that there isn't a true church upon the earth. But when it is, you know, he will find it. He'll be a part of it. Well, for Martin, it's kind of like he packages that all up, puts it away, and now you see him determining, well, if I'm an unchurched Christian, I'm just going to be a Christian, and I'm going to get really involved and increase my wealth. One of the things Martin was really good at was weaving, and he actually won several awards for his weaving from what was called the Ontario Agricultural Society. We also see Martin is very, very busy. And we all know how to be busy with big things, mostly small things. But in the case of Martin, well, he even starts trying to get money for the Greeks who are fighting against the Turks. He gets very involved in the Erie Canal. He sees his weaving. He sees his small animal business, being able to send things up and down the Erie Canal. He sees himself taking in a sister-in-law when her husband had been drowned in a horrible accident. So Polly Cobb joins his home. He builds a 1.5-story home for his wife. In other words, everything he touches seems to turn to gold. And then he has an event. So the event goes like this. He hires then Joseph Smith Sr., and he hires then Hiram. And you'd say, what's he doing? He's decided, well, he's hired several of the Smiths before. There's even some thought he hired young Joseph Smith to help him on his property. But as he's building this 1.5-story home for his wife, he's almost all but done and concludes that he wants to wall up the basement a little bit better, and he wants a well dug in his front yard. And so he hires two people not in his social class. You might call them common laborers. In other words, you would think, well, a friendship won't result from this. It's just a money transaction kind of deal. But he hires Joseph Smith Sr. and his son Hiram to wall up the basement and to dig this well. In the course of doing so, Martin now starts approaching Joseph Smith Sr., a man much more his age, and begins asking him questions about rumors he's heard in town, about Joseph Smith, gold plates, Angel Moroni. And Father Smith, at first, concludes, I'm not going to tell him. In other words, I want this job. I don't want to be kicked off the job. This is good. You know, we need to be able to make our mortgage payment. And finally, Joseph Smith Sr. confides in Martin Harris. Now, the impact is unbelievable. What Martin had been so interested in, whether it was his small animals, whether it was weaving, whether it was getting money for the Greeks, whether it's taking care of his sister-in-law, you know, whatever his dad's properties, his work in town, suddenly none of that matters to him. And what he thinks about, what he's absorbed about, is young Joseph Smith and the fact that an angel has appeared to him. and that there is a book on gold plates. And Martin is very, very curious. Well, we find what happens is that we now come to October of 1827. In October of 1827, recall that Joseph Smith has been to the Hill Cumorah from 1823, 24, 25, 26, 27, and by September of 27, he has received the plates. And there are all kinds of rumors going through town that Joseph has the plates. Has he told Martin? And the answer is no. He actually hasn't told Martin. And rumors are going, and Martin has heard it. And finally, Joseph says to his mother, Lucy Mack Smith, go to Martin's house, which is about 3 miles away, and tell Martin I want to see him. And so Lucy doesn't want to do it. And the reason is because of Martin's wife. By this point, Lucy Harris, she has gone partially deaf. She's a woman with a private purse, meaning she doesn't have to ask her husband for money. She can do with her money what she wants, which was most unusual for the time period. And somehow Lucy Harris, in Lucy Mack Smith's mind, sees herself better than Mother Smith. But Mother Smith finally agrees, and she goes to the Harris home to tell Martin that young Joseph Smith wants to speak to him. When she does, it's awkward. But the result will be, she goes there, finally she's able to see Martin, and she tells him that Joseph needs him, that he wants to talk to him, and he said, oh, that's great. He says, I've just finished my work, and he says, I'm going to get a hired hand to help me. And he says, I'm going to have him work for me for a year. I'm going to take time off, and I'm going to travel. And you think, wow, that's different. Martin, you got a family. You know, you've got kids growing up. And Martin is, by this point, is feeling like, hey, I've earned the right. I'm free. I'm going to take a year off. And so he decides to go see young Joseph to find out the news. He's curious. Is it true, the rumor in town? As he does so, we're going to find that Lucy Harris, his wife, now insists that she goes with him. They both then talk to young Joseph. Joseph indicates that he can't show him the plates, but yes, he does have them. It's interesting, on this occasion, Lucy Harris, the wife of Martin, remember his first cousin, becomes the first person to actually give Joseph Smith money to help him in the translation effort. And so she gives him $28, which is the first money he receives for the translation of the book. Now, before we finish tonight, we're going to find that she completely reverses herself and will take Joseph to court. But at least her initial reaction is, sure, I'm going to help pay for this.
And the money is for him to sustain him, so he
right.
doesn't have to
work.
To
sustain him, well, so he's not out there grubbing in the field, you know, other things that he might have to do, but to sustain him, right, Clayton, while he does the translation. We're going to find that for Joseph Smith, he's unable, despite this financial kind of reserve he now has, but he's unable to do any translation in Palmyra. The reason is he has to keep the plates safe. And there just doesn't seem to be a quiet place. You see Joseph hiding the plates from people called treasure hunters or money diggers. At one point, he hides them in his dad's Cooper loft. Another time, he's hid them out in a field in a log. And you'd say, Joseph, are you able to do any translation of these plates in Palmyra? And the answer is no.
And that's just because he's spending so much time trying to keep them safe and
keep him safe. There just doesn't seem to be a room, a space. Where can he do this? And so Joseph's decision is that he will now move back to the area where Emma was born and from, Harmony, Pennsylvania, which is about 130 miles away, and that with not a lot of rumors down there, that perhaps he can then translate in Harmony, Pennsylvania. He makes a deal with Martin, and Martin will now give him additional monies to be able to make the journey. In fact, if we look at what Martin did, he gave Joseph $50, you know, not quite double what his wife had done, but he gives him $50 so he can take Emma and head now to Harmony, Pennsylvania to translate. Martin even buys Joseph a black suit. He thinks Joseph needs to look more like the preachers that Martin has seen coming into town. And so extra money now heads out with the idea that Joseph will do some translation and Martin will join him there in Harmony, Pennsylvania. What Martin's to do when he joins him is that Joseph will now give Martin what are called some characters that it's just a slip of paper that Joseph has copied from the Book of Mormon with the idea that Martin will take these characters to fancy people in New York City, you know, scholars, people that could tell Martin what it means, you know, are they legit? Here's what Joseph has found. And so
and this Martin, was Martin's idea or Joseph's idea for him to take them
well,
to
it
New
seems
York?
To be a little bit combined both, but definitely Joseph sees this as something that would be of value. We see that Martin will now take this slip of paper, the characters, and we know of at least two people that Martin will show these characters to in New York City. One is a man named Dr. Samuel Mitchell, and as another is named Charles Anthon. Both Samuel Mitchell has shown real interest in early Indian relics. Charles Mitchell is a student scholar of languages, and these men will be shown that. Next, and, we find
on this slide here is Samuel Mitchell, the one on the left.
Yes.
Okay.
Good.
Only if you're watching, don't stop what you're doing necessarily.
Yeah.
But
yeah, don't stop running.
So they're both just black and white photos of old looking guys. Very, but you know, smart looking guys too.
Yeah,
I guess.
Smart, no doubt. Next, we find that Martin and Lucy, after this trip to see these famous scholars, go to see Joseph in Harmony, Pennsylvania. And at this point, Lucy is now very upset. She feels that, one, her husband's been gone, kind of on a wild goose chase, and perhaps in her mind. She is also concerned that Martin has given him money to support, you know, his any translation efforts. And when Lucy arrives at the home, she now demands from Joseph she wants to see the plates. In other words, no more clandestine kind of operation. Show me the plates. And Joseph will now refuse. Lucy becomes angry, leaves the house, stays with someone else, eventually is taken by Martin back to Palmyra. But from this point on, you'd say, how's this marriage going between Martin and his first cousin? I go, not very well. What is the issue? And the issue is always Joseph Smith and the gold plates. So then we need to figure out which way will Martin go. Martin actually becomes the scribe. Remember how he said, hey, I'm going to hire somebody to take over my work here. I've got a year. And so you'd say instead of Martin traveling the States or, I don't know, going on a sea voyage, instead he goes to Harmony, Pennsylvania, and he becomes a scribe to the first book that Joseph will translate called the Book of Lehi. as he works on these papers, they're called Foolscape papers, he actually has scribed 116 pages. And by this point, they've finished then this Book of Lehi. So you can see as he's done these pages, Martin now asks Joseph, can I take these pages home? In other words, can I show these original writings to my wife, Lucy? And so as you see, you know, copies obviously of just handwriting, we know that he will ask Joseph, not just once, and Joseph will say no, not just a second time, but a third time. And the answer becomes a very qualified yes from the Lord, that there are five people in Martin's immediate family that he can show. He can show his mom and dad, okay, Nathan and Rhoda Harris. He can show his brother Preservant Harris, who lives down the street. He can show his wife Lucy, and he can show her sister Polly Cobb, who's staying with Lucy in their home. And only those five people. So with that promise, on June 14th, 1828, Martin now takes the 116 pages from Harmony, Pennsylvania, to Palmyra to show his family members. Now recall, he makes serious covenants that he will not show the pages to anyone else. Well, disaster now hits. And the disaster is that Martin Harris breaks his covenant. And he shows it to one. And some people even say he's got it out on the streets of Palmyra, showing it to many. Well, he doesn't come back. 3 weeks have come and gone. Joseph and Emma have had their first child. The child dies within a few hours. And Joseph and despairs for Emma's life.
And that's kind of the reason, right? Because the original plan was for Joseph to go up with him.
Right.
And part of the reason he didn't was because Emma was pregnant with her first child and wasn't doing well.
Not doing well at all.
She was, like you said, he feared for her life.
And so that, Joseph now, finally, it's Emma that's saying to Joseph, where's Martin? You know, you need to go find Martin. You need to get the pages back. Well, Joseph now takes a stagecoach, eventually gets home after a few days and comes inside and says to his family, hey, somebody go get Martin for me. In other words, go the 3 miles. Hiram Smith goes to Martin's house and says, Joseph's here. You know, come, we've got breakfast ready. And they wait and wait and wait, and it's now about 11 o'clock, and no Martin. You'd say, what's he doing? Well, He can't find the pages. He talks about he's taking his house literally apart. You know, where are they? Where are they? And finally, he's seen sitting on the fence. He eventually comes into this Smith farmhouse. They sit up to eat. Martin can hardly hold a fork. He's shaking. And Hiram Smith asks him, what's wrong, Martin? And Martin says, I have lost my soul. At which point, Joseph says to him, have you lost the manuscript? In other words, have you lost the 116 pages that you had been the scribe for? And when Martin says yes, Joseph says, not only have you lost your soul, you've lost mine. In other words, all this preparation, you know, first vision, God the Father, Jesus Christ, 3 years later, here comes Angel Moroni, 1823. Hey, your name will be known for good and evil. I'm going to tell you why. You know, it's up there to the hill Cumorah. Can't get the plates yet. You know, the big buildup from 23 to 27. He gets the plates, finally able to start translating, and everything is gone. Now, Joseph will attempt to find them. Martin, of course, will attempt to find him, others, but at this point, they're still lost. So what's the impact for Martin Harris and his family? Well, things go really south now between Martin and Lucy. She wants a separation.
And his whole reason for wanting them was to save his marriage.
Right.
So, partly, right?
Yeah. So, yes, you're right. So he's going home to try and save this marriage, kind of repair things between him and Lucy. And now everything is bad because he's accusing her of being involved in this stealing and, you know, perhaps passing him to a neighbor or someone else. And so at this point, there's so much discord that we get what's happening then in the Harris household. Martin will give his wife 80 acres and a house that he owns, like a rental house, right? You get Martin continues to support Joseph as scribe, but perhaps the worst that happens is that Lucy now takes Joseph Smith to court, and she becomes the first woman to take Joseph to court. And what she's claiming is that he has deceived her husband and that he's taking money from her husband on a deception. And the interesting thing, Oliver Cowdery's brother, Lyman Cowdery, actually is the lawyer that is in support of Lucy Harris that has her. Well, you get all these people in this court case. The Smiths go. It's very difficult for the Smiths at this point. Incredibly difficult for Martin. You get neighbors now will testify that they've been hearing rumors of young Joseph Smith for years. Eventually, Martin's asked to testify, and in his testimony, he indicates that Joseph didn't steal money for him, take it unwisely, and says, if Joseph wants everything I have, he can have it. Now, you realize that cements a relationship between Joseph and Martin, but what does that do for Martin's marriage? Right? For a woman who's already on the outs with her husband, we know at this point that they now, obviously, the separation, which is never mended, and when Lucy dies, that Martin has already moved on to Kirtland, Ohio.
And we haven't gone to the end of this period, but Joseph describes it as his darkest days.
All right, little correction here. I couldn't find where Joseph said exactly they were his darkest days, but something similar to that. I'm reading The History of the Prophet Joseph Smith by his mother, Lucy Mack Smith. Excellent book. He does say, or well, she says this: I well remember that day of darkness, both within and without. To us at least, the heavens seemed clothed with blackness and the earth shrouded with gloom. I have often said within myself that if a continual punishment as severe as that which we experienced on that occasion were to be inflicted upon the most wicked characters who ever stood upon the footstool of the Almighty, if even their punishment were no greater than that, I should feel to pity their condition.
Darkest days for Joseph, and I think very dark days for Martin, because he had this amazing opportunity to be a scribe, but he will no longer be asked. In other words, he had a great chance, but he broke that covenant, and Joseph will then turn to others. Well, what happens for Martin? You know, repentance is real. I think we can all say that, Clayton, in our own lives. But Martin has a few opportunities I think should be shared with our group. We know that Martin Harris becomes one of the three witnesses to the Book of Mormon. And I think that's pretty great. You know, amidst all of that, he's still called to be something really important. And his testimony appears in every Book of Mormon, whether it's bought or given. Ever since it's been published, he's there. The other two witnesses then, Oliver Cowdery and David Whitmer. It's interesting, after Martin is shown the plates by an angel, his comment is, "'Tis enough, mine eyes have beheld." In other words, you know, I took the characters to New York. You know, I've tried this, I took the pages, I've tried to convince everybody, But now I've actually seen for myself, 'tis enough my eyes beheld.
And am I right that when the witnesses were shown the Book of Mormon, they knelt together and weren't getting the witness they knew they were looking for, and then Martin departed and said, it's me, I need to, and he went off to pray by himself for a while.
Right.
Meanwhile, the angel comes to Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery and David Whitmer.
Right.
And then later, is it Joseph Smith that goes and joins Martin, and then...
Right, the very same day.
Yeah, and then he gets the same visitation.
Uh-huh. Totally correct. And once Martin has seen then the plates and the angel and says, 'tis enough, mine eyes have beheld. Joseph, when he goes back to the Peter Whitmer little cabin that he had there, his mother was there, and Joseph says, I am not any longer alone. In other words, I've been carrying this heavy burden all alone, and now I have three others that will testify. Well, what else did Martin do for the prophet Joseph? Martin was willing to literally put on the line his 150 acres that he had put together to ensure that the Book of Mormon would be published. And it's published by this man, whose name is Ebert Grandin. E.B. Grandin is how he is known. Because of the financial backing that Martin put into this publication, we find that the following happened. We know that 5,000 copies of the Book of Mormon was printed for $3,000. And you'd say, what happened to the 150 acres? Well, Martin Harris eventually had to sell them to cover the debt because the Book of Mormon was not selling as well as everyone had planned. Original copies back then, you could buy them for $1.25. Today, hard to touch them for $10,000, right? And more, depending on whose signature's in it. But what was Martin willing to give for his faith? I guess that's how I'd like to end this, Clayton. It seems to me that Martin was a searcher. Okay. He had an amazing heritage of people that were separatists, that were just, you know, trying to find a religion that would work. And then for Martin, when he learns about young Joseph Smith, and the Book of Mormon plates, Angel Moroni, just everything in his life seemed superfluous. It didn't seem to matter as much. But what did he lose because of his conviction? Well, separated from his wife, which means his children too. His farm he'd put together. His reputation, his town, as people began to mock him like they did Joseph Smith. That just marveled that such a man as Martin, who was considered a reputable gentleman in town, would believe this. But what did he gain? We know that for years, literally, Martin left the church. And like you said, Clayton, he's looking for all these others. But I think the part I really like, at the end of his life, he's well into his 80s. He's missing all his teeth. He's come to Utah. If you were to look at the three witnesses and eight witnesses, he's our only witness that makes it all the way to Utah. And one time while he's in Salt Lake City, he's gone up on a little hill overlooking the town. And his comment would be, as he looked down on the town, who would guess the Book of Mormon could have done all of this? And, could the Book of Mormon have come forth without Martin's financial help? There wasn't anybody else that was expressing interest in the church that had the money he had. And it's, despite his ills and despite ours, right? There was a time that he stood up and he really did the right thing. So, yeah. I hope in the next life I'm able to meet somebody as great as Martin Harris.
I love that final analysis, Susan. Martin gets a lot of flack, I guess, from the Lord, right? The Lord, I mean, the Lord isn't shy about chastising people.
Right, calling him an evil man.
Yeah, a wicked man, right?
Yeah.
But we, I mean, if he's wicked, maybe some of us are at sometimes, but he, as I was reading, because I read a little bit about him today, you know, again, I read kind of the Wikipedia stuff on him, but I just think despite his shortcomings, and obviously that just absolutely heart-wrenching episode of him losing the manuscript, which must have been horrible for him as it was for Joseph Smith. Of course, we know the Lord planned for that in advance. But despite that and the other things, his sacrifice, his farm, his finances, like you said, his reputation, he was known as a man with integrity even before he met Joseph Smith. And at the end of his life, on his deathbed and stuff, he witnessed of seeing the Book of Mormon and of Joseph Smith. He said, I can't remember exactly his words about the prophet, but that he was a true prophet. He didn't say that in the middle of his life when he was apart from the church, but at the end he did.
Right.
But he never left his testimony of the Book of Mormon, and he said something like, somebody asked him, is the Book of Mormon, or did you really see the plates, or are those real or something? And he's like, well, see the sun up there? You know, is that real? Just as much as I know the sun is there, I'm quoting this all wrong. You should look it up. But he also said, I may as well doubt my own existence as doubt that the Book of Mormon is true, because I know it.
Right.
Anyway,
just
so.
An amazing testimony.
Yeah.
I sure like that, you know, you can really mess up your life, but the Lord will still ask you to do very important things, you know, if you're willing to be humble and come back.
And be prepared for the adversary to really go at you hard if you're going to get involved in this work.
Right.
With your whole heart, I guess.
Yeah. Hey, well, Clayton, I'd love to hear How Firm a Foundation. I think, you know, Martin,
let's do it.
You know, had this firm foundation that in many respects, there was a time he was willing to give his all.
So I'm going to let you, Susan, pick any verse between 4 and 7.
Ooh, I like that. Well, okay, how about 7? We want to know how it ends.
Okay, well, you've heard this one.
The soul that on Jesus hath leaned for repose, I will not, I cannot desert to his foes. That soul, though all hell should endeavor to shake, I'll never, no, never, I'll never, no, never, I'll never, no, never, no, never forsake.
Sounds like Martin, right?
Yep.
I'll be happy to see him too. All right. Well, thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
That is a little brief picture of Martin Harris, the man, one of the witnesses of the Book of Mormon. You can read his words along with David Whitmer and Oliver Cowdery in any Book of Mormon. Again, I'm here with the amazing Susan Easton Black. It's good to be with you.
You too.
We'll talk next time.